Something about the life of Mozart seems to inspire dramatists to make things up. First there was Amadeus, a play, then a movie, that imagines Mozart tormented and ultimately destroyed by a rival composer. And now a new French film suggests that at an early age, he had another very different kind of rival. Bob Mondello reviews Mozart's sister.
Imagine that your little brother took up music because he admired you, then took over your spot as the family prodigy when you were both still very young, and you were reduced to being his accompanist when he did concerts for royalty all over Europe. A recipe for filial disaster, no? Except the Mozart kids, 15-year-old Nannerl and 11-year-old Wolfgang, adored each other. We meet them as they're traveling from one grand estate to another, playing for their supper. Dad walks in the snow while the kids amuse themselves inside the carriage, at one point by playing violin duets. But Nannerl's not allowed to play violin. It's a boy's instrument, says Dad.
Nannerl! C'était interdit de toucher un violon.
Dad has lots of rules, most of which seem to favor little Wolfie. Nannerl is told, for instance, that composing music is beyond a girl's capabilities. Then she meets the Dauphin, heir to the French throne, by employing a little subterfuge that will later show up in her brother's operas. She dresses as a boy, and as a boy, she gets to compose and play the violin.
Alors, allez-y.
Director René Ferré cast his own daughter, Marie, as Nannerl, and she's persuasive, whether obediently sitting at a harpsichord or surreptitiously composing by candlelight. Mozart's sister follows the general contours of this musical family's real life. Strict father, acquiescent mother, non-stop concert tours to keep food on the table. And if the most arresting plot points are invented, well, as what-ifs go, they're fun. Two kids so music-besotted they wake each other up every morning by inventing new melodies. Then a mad dash, still in nightgowns, for a harpsichord, where they wake up the rest of the family, playing in tandem. Pre-revolutionary France, on the other hand, does not appear to have been a fun place for girls or women, whether in the royal court, where daughters got sent to live in convents, or in musical families, where their talents got squelched. The film depicts all this without imposing contemporary attitudes, and it does so lavishly on what was apparently a tiny budget, because the filmmakers benefited from one enormous bonus. They were allowed to film at the Palace of Versailles. Mozart's sister is consequently kind of gorgeous, shot after candlelit shot, looking like old master paintings, and music, of course, to take your breath away. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know that TV show about being smarter than a fifth grader? I want to introduce you to two kids who are just entering the fourth grade this year. We're going to give those fifth graders a run for their smarts. They're two winners of the Kids Science Challenge. That's a competition put together by the creator of the Pulse of the Planet radio program, you know, veteran Jim Metzner. But instead of a robot competition like FIRST Robotics, this one challenges kids to, in the third to sixth grades, to think about a problem, a question, a need that science could solve. And then the winners get paired up with a science mentor, a scientist, to explore their idea and find the solution. You can find out more about it or learn how to enter next year at kidsciencechallenge.com. And we have two of the winners with us here today. Mary Benjamin will be entering the fourth grade at Pine Cobble School in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Her entry was the winner in the Sensational Sounds category of Kids Science Challenge. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to have you. Peyton Robertson, incoming fourth grader at Pinecrest School in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, His idea was the winner in the Super Stuff for Sports category. Welcome, Peyton.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. If you're a kid with an idea, you'd like to talk with our kids, our number is 1-800-989-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Mary, let me begin with you. Tell us about your project. What was that?
Well, I took two spray bottles, or two or three or four, or something like that, and I pretty much just sprayed water into a tin can, and the tin can had a tube attached to it, and it led back into the spray bottle, so you would never run out of water.
Hmm. And you were making a musical instrument?
Yeah.
By spraying the tin can and, I guess, changing the sound by how? How did you change the different sounds the can would make?
We found different kinds of cans, and we also tuned them a little bit by putting pressure on them, because you can tune tin cans. If you put pressure on them, they become higher. Also, if the tin cans have bigger ridges on the bottom, then they're higher too.
Hmm. All right, we have actually a little bit of music that you played for us on your tin can. Let's have a listen. That's Ode to Joy, is it not?
Yep.
I could recognize that. That's very good. Peyton, you had a different project. What was your project?
I love golf. I play golf every weekend. And my idea was to create a ball warmer, which would preserve the golf ball's temperature so it doesn't lose distance. Because from my experiment, I noticed that a golf ball doesn't fly as far when it's cold.
So you made a ball warmer, a golf ball warmer. How does that work?
Well, we never actually made it, but here's what I thought it would look like. I thought it would be like a thermos technology. So it would be a vacuum flask, and there would be four or five different compartments. Each compartment would hold a ball.
It would keep the ball's temperature the same. So in the cold parts of the country, the performance could still be consistent.
And what kind of research did you do in preparing for this?
Well, I cracked open several golf balls.
That's not an easy thing to do, cracking open.
Well, my talents help me. I also Googled how golf balls are made.
Right.
And I heated 10 balls on my parents heated 10 balls on the stove. We kept 10 at room temperature, and I put 10 in the freezer, and then we dropped all 30 of them off the top of a ladder, and we measured how high they bounced, and the hot and the room temperature balls bounce significantly higher than the cold balls.
Wow, you did a real science experiment there. Then you collected data, you did an experiment, an idea, and it all worked out. Is there a product here you think you can market something that keep golf balls a little higher to work well? And does it violate any golfing rules when you do that?
Heating it in like a microwave is not legal, but we're pretty sure that just keeping the temperature constant is legal.
Did you actually try to hit some golf balls or have them hit at all at a higher temperature? Did they go any further, or could you discover anything about them? You'd bounce them, and that was high enough, I guess.
When we went to my reward for winning was to go to the University of Southern Mississippi, and I met Dr. Savin, and we made some golf balls out of a super elastic polymer
right.
that would perform well at any temperature.
Wow.
And I got to hit those balls, and they definitely went further than regular balls.
All right, Titleist, watch out. Mary, how did you get your idea to work on this?
It's kind of a funny story. I was really running out of time to come up with an idea. I had come up with ideas for both the other categories, but I had no idea for this one. It was going to be very difficult to come up with an idea. But I thought about what they had said about thinking about something that no one would really guess could be a musical instrument. And then I looked around my room, and the first thing that I saw was a spray bottle, which I used to clean my guinea pig cage. And then pretty much the idea just popped into my head. And I went downstairs. I said, "Dad, I have an idea." I did a couple experiments, and that was pretty much it.
It's interesting that you were not afraid to tell people about your idea, that you might be afraid they might laugh at you.
Not really.
Yeah.
I didn't really tell. I kind of told them about my idea, but I wasn't really allowed to tell them that I had won.
Hmm.
So it was hard to explain everything.
Yeah. Do you think someone else will build your idea and market it?
I don't know, but my aunt is a musician, and she said that she might use it in one of her concerts. So
wow.
That's pretty cool.
Did you have to experiment with different kinds of objects to find out which one made the best sound?
Yeah. I built two prototypes before I went to California, which is where I got to go because I won. And before I went there, I built two prototypes. They didn't look very much like the final product, but and I had to do a lot of experimenting with which sounds worked best until I decided that tin cans were what worked.
I have a question for both of you. Actually, it was one that I was going to ask, but came in a tweet from Baby Lou, who says, "What do you say to kids who think science is boring and useless? What do you say to them?"
I didn't always love science. You just gotta experiment. You have to come up with fun activities that you can do yourself, that you learn from and that are very entertaining. And pretty much after that, you just kind of love science.
Mm-hmm. Peyton, do you have an answer for that?
I think that you shouldn't think about it as science. You should think about it as how things work. Because if you think about it that way, then it becomes much, much more interesting.
Just don't call it science. Just try to figure out how the world works.
Right.
Do you have a follow-up? Do you have any other idea you're working on now?
Not really. Just I hope to make a prototype of my ball warmer, but besides that.
Yeah. Some other idea, and we'll hit you. And Mary, do you have any improvement that you can make or a follow up?
I've been kind of thinking about that. I've been experimenting with the one that I built, and trying to come up with ways to make it better. So it's kind of an interesting project. I'm like drawing pictures of ways that it could become more interesting. The one that I built is portable. We used Velcro to make it. But it's still pretty big, so I'm trying to come up with a way that maybe next time it'll be more portable.
Let me ask you both. What do your friends say about what you're doing?
I haven't haven't talked to him in a while. I've been away for most of the summer, and I was allowed to tell them right before school ended. But they seem pretty excited, interested. They put lots of, when I went to California, they put lots and lots of questions on my blog the questions that they had that I could think about when I built it, and then maybe I could answer them.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time with us, and good luck to you, too. Mary Benjamin of Williamstown, Massachusetts, Peyton Robertson of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, winners of the Kids Science Challenge. You can find out more about that at kidsciencechallenge.com or go to our website. Good luck to you both, and thanks for coming on Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hope to see you on your next project.
One thing consumers won't be paying more for, or anything at all for that matter, is Hewlett-Packard's touchpad. Our last word in business today is, you can't touch this. After launching its new tablet just weeks ago, HP announced yesterday it's pulling the plug on the touchpad.
The touchpad got, at best, a lukewarm reception from critics. One early sign all was not well with the new product was a $100 price drop just after it was launched.
Then reports started circulating that Best Buy had sold less than 10% of the 270,000 touchpads in its inventory. HP is the world's largest desktop and laptop computer seller. The company also revealed yesterday that it is considering spinning off or selling its personal computing business. And that is the business news from Morning Edition on NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
You can't touch this.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Golden Empire is British historian Hugh Thomas's latest work. It is, like most of Thomas's books, big and sweeping, peopled by dozens of historical characters, some of whom are familiar, many of whom are obscure. It is the second volume in Thomas's three-volume history of the Spanish Empire. It covers the years of the reign of Charles V, who was both King of Spain and Emperor of Europe in the 1500s. For his many works of history, about the Spanish Civil War, about Cuba, about Europe, Thomas, who turns 80 in a couple of months, was ennobled some years back. He is Lord Thomas, and he joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And to this lay reader, your book picks up a couple of decades after the spectacular stories of the unification of Christian Spain, the Inquisition, Columbus, and that it ends a couple of decades before the defeat of the Armada, which I can still remember from history class. What's so important about this second act, the years in between that are the subject of this book?
Well, this is the period when Charles V was, in effect, the Emperor of Europe, the universal emperor. He thought he might run the world. He was, in a sense, a kind of president of the United States in waiting. And his multicultural, multinational empire is not quite dissimilar to the variety of which the United States is now.
Indeed, or as continental Europe is now. There's
or
at least one moment
continental Europe.
His Spanish subjects complain about those bureaucrats from Brussels back in the
1500s. That's quite right. They did that, and they complained about the bureaucrats from Brussels now.
For me, this story becomes most gripping in the conquest of Peru, when Francisco Pizarro and his brothers lead a very small group of Spaniards against fairly advanced Incan empire and capture it. And there's a moment that you describe, a massacre in Cajamarca, that I wonder if you could set the stage for us there.
Well, that was the beginning of the collapse of the old Inca Empire. What happened was that Pizarro and his brothers and his friends arrived in the main square of Cajamarca, which is in northern Peru, and Atahualpa, the Inca emperor, as we call him, sent messages, and there was an exchange. And Atahualpa then came into the square of Cajamarca with some of his nobles, and Pizarro and his friends massacred them on the accusation that they were plotting to destroy the Spaniards. The Spaniards were so very few, and they were extremely nervous, I think, and they didn't know what they were going to do till the very last minute. But then they thought, well, we must capture Atahualpa, which they did, and we'll kill as many of his supporters as we can. And that's what happened, and that was the beginning of the Spanish Empire in Peru.
You write in the book, that terrible day in the square of Cajamarca was not forgotten. Indeed, it would be repeated.
That's correct. And it's cast a shadow over Spanish history in that part of the world ever since. Charles V reproached Pizarro for having Atahualpa killed. He did have him killed later. And more or less said, you were not there to kill kings. You were there to capture them and to treat with them, but your responsibility is to deal with them, not to kill them. Because he was a bit nervous that might have a very bad example in Europe for himself.
You have now been immersed in this trilogy about Spain for some years, I assume. You've been immersed in Renaissance Europe and the Spanish Empire. You tell your readers where each Spanish conquistador came from, his family background, whether he was literate. It feels as though you almost know these people. Do you feel like you almost know these people?
Well, I feel they're friends, many of them, I must say, and I'm interested where they came from. I'm interested to think of how these remarkable people who, whatever their faults, they were certainly brave, they took risks, they experienced enormous hardships, and it is true. I was interested to think, how is it possible that someone coming from a small town in Extremadura in Spain, Mérida, that they could spend their lives in South America creating an empire on behalf of the King of Spain. An astounding achievement.
Hugh Thomas, you've also written throughout your career much more recent histories about the Spanish Civil War. The first book of yours that I ever saw as a teenager was one about the Suez Crisis of 1956, a slim report on that. Is it more attractive to you to write entirely from old archives and documents and artifacts of 500 years ago, or to investigate a story where there are living witnesses, not to mention newsreels, photographs, recordings of people speaking?
Well, I have now become completely used to writing about the 16th century, where the evidence is all archival and the interpretation of documents. I have written books about modern history. It's perfectly true, you remind me. And I'm still thought of in Spain to some extent as Hugh Thomas of the Spanish Civil War, although I've had a strange experience in Spain, because when my book came out first on the Spanish Civil War, I was thought to be violently left. Now I'm thought to be right. So that's an interesting experience,
well,
which I rather enjoy.
Have you changed much over the years, or is it entirely the perspective of your critics who has changed?
I think they've changed. I don't think I have myself changed very much. You mentioned that I was in the House of Lords. Well, actually, I made two speeches in the House of Lords this year, and one might have been said to be on the left, and one might have been said to be on the right. So I've kept an even keel, you might say.
As someone, as you say, who's been criticized at various times for being too far left or being too far right, as someone who, you know, finds the conquistadors, they feel like friends to you. I just wonder, this is a subject, the conquest of America, that's been written about in most recent years. I think the view of the Spanish has been far less sympathetic than you would give it. What's right here? How should we view this entire
Well,
era?
I think we must certainly recognize it was an astounding achievement. I recognize that they were brutal and sometimes contradictory, sometimes foolish. But still, I admire their achievement more than I condemn it. But an important point, which I mention quite a lot in this book, is that the Spaniards discussed as to whether they had any right to be in the New World. Had they was there any justification for their conquests? And I think I'd emphasize the fact that in no other imperial history, the British or the Roman or the French or the Chinese, do we see such a discussion of this nature. I mean, my father was in...
Right. As someone who, you know, finds the conquistadors, they feel like friends to you. I just wonder, this is a subject, the conquest of America, that's been written about in most recent years. I think the view of the Spanish has been far less sympathetic than you would give it. What's right here? How should we view this entire
Well,
era?
I think we must certainly recognize it was an astounding achievement. I recognize that they were brutal and sometimes contradictory, sometimes foolish. But still, I admire their achievement more than I condemn it. But an important point, which I mention quite a lot in this book, is that the Spaniards discussed as to whether they had any right to be in the New World. Had they was there any justification for their conquests? And I think I'd emphasize the fact that in no other imperial history, the British or the Roman or the French or the Chinese, do we see such a discussion of this nature. I mean, my father was in Africa all his life. He was a good man, but he never wondered why he was there. He never thought, well, we must have a discussion with the Africans as to whether we are right to be here.
It was just self-evident, you mean?
It was self-evident.
Yeah, this is the role that the civilizing mission, as the French would say.
Monday will mark 15 years since former President Bill Clinton signed a law that he said would end welfare as we know it. The measure was hailed as a way to get the poor into the labor force and to free them from dependence on government aid. But a new report questions how well that program worked during the recent recession. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
When President Clinton signed the new welfare law, he said it wasn't perfect, but that it did provide an historic chance to fix a system that didn't work.
Today we are ending welfare as we know it, but I hope this day will be remembered not for what it ended, but for what it began.
What it was supposed to begin was a program that would get the poor working and end their sometimes suffocating reliance on public aid. But in bad economic times, it was also supposed to provide a safety net. A new study finds that, in fact, that hasn't always been the case over the past few years.
We think this is really a very weak response to such a high and prolonged unemployment rate.
Sheila Zidleski is with the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. She notes that unemployment rates went up 88% during the recession, but caseloads in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF program, which welfare is now called, rose by only 14%.
And if you look across the country, states have very different experiences.
And in some cases, the numbers are striking. While caseloads rose in most states during the recession, they actually dropped in 13. In Arizona, for example, where joblessness shot up 134%, the number of households getting cash assistance went down 48%.
On the face of it, I think it's bad. That was not the intent of the program.
Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution should know. He helped to craft welfare reform as a lead Republican staffer on Capitol Hill. Haskins says the program's response to the recession has raised a serious question.
Can we have a cash program that is pro-work and has tough work requirements, but also will help people get back on the rolls and get cash during hard times because they can't find employment?
He notes that other safety net programs, such as unemployment insurance and supplemental nutrition assistance or food stamps, responded a whole lot better to the bad economy. And in fact, the huge growth in those programs is one reason that people think that welfare caseloads didn't go up more, because some struggling families were able to get help elsewhere. Haskins also says that getting people off welfare, which was a lot easier to do in a good economy, appears to have become a goal in itself for some states.
On its face, the caseload's low, therefore more people are working. Well, we know that's not true.
Still, it's made TANF a ripe target for cash-strapped states. Some have tightened eligibility requirements. Others have reduced benefits. Arizona, for example, has cut the lifetime limit for aid from 5 years to 2. Clarence Carter runs the state's Department of Economic Security. He says that's the biggest reason for their caseload decline.
The governor and legislature want there to be an aggressive, urgent move to try to move these families who so desperately need it through the system and not have them reside in it.
So his main focus now is job training and other efforts to find people work. Although he admits in Arizona, as elsewhere, unemployment is still discouragingly high. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Time now for another summer sound.
It's summertime.
Commentator Andre Kudrescu finds summer in the panting of his dogs.
Sally Marie is becoming a lady of a certain age.
She has long, delicate legs, and her slight pot belly looks right above all four of them as she keeps pace with her younger, more uncouth, and insanely playful new companion, Lula Harp. Their styles couldn't be more different, and as they trudge up and down and up again the gravel road through the woods in the 103 degrees heat, they both do their job splendidly. Sally Marie stalks silently the somnolent wildlife at the roadside, and Lula Harp barks her head off at anything that looks half alien like a parked car. What they both do on these long expeditions that Laura and I take for our postprandial constitutional is pant. Both Sally Marie and Lula Harp pant for all they are worth, mouth open, tongues hanging out, gasping breath and drool, one package of canine exertion. Their names tell it all. Sally Marie is part terrier native elegance, and is quiet most of the time. She listens and stalks. Lula, who got her last name from Harp's grocery store, where Laura adopted her as a pup from a teenager, is some kind of beagle and chihuahua mix, a bichihuahua or maybe a minipin, an Ozarks-specific combination that I hear goes for big bucks on eBay. Anyway, she is fearless, charming, and clumsy, and does not hesitate to throw herself from any height, using her floppy ears as a parachute and landing sort of on the ground. Sally Marie, on the other hand, calculates distances and heights with the cold eye of a geometrist and springs elegantly up to the exact spot of her calculations, or down, whatever the case. But different as they are, they both pant, not halfway through the walk. By the end of it, they could be heard panting from a mile off and give off that lovely smell of sweaty, tired dog that is sweet, acrid, and smug, as if it were some kind of trophy substance. Neither one of them turns down the walk, there being treats at the end of it, but the treats are, of course, different. Lady Sally Marie will have only beef rawhides, while carefree Lula is practically a hippie. She'll gobble apple, grapes, peach, and nuts. But they pant. They pant like overexerted athletes, and they wallow in the glory of their panting slime like Olympic gymnasts. The lady and the tramp are one in panting sisterhood. The sound of summer, all right.
A Summer Sound from Andrei Cădrescu, author of Whatever Gets You Through the Night, a story of Scheherazade and the Arabian Entertainments.
You're listening to All Things Considered.